Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today I'll be interviewing Frank King. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you'll receive alerts when new episodes are available on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, please leave me a review on iTunes or Spotify. How did you become known as the mental health comedian? Because I saw that title and I was like, wow, that's interesting. I've never heard of a comedian, you know, even really tackle mental health.
Well, and there are others out there. My first TED talk that you saw was my coming out as a depressed and suicidal person. Nobody knew. My family, my friends, my wife didn't know. And I've been a comedian all that time, and I always wanted to make a living and a difference. I could just never figure out how to do the "and a difference" part. What do I have to teach people? How can I help people in the way of a keynote? You know, what can they walk away with? So I bought a book by Judy Carter called The Message of You. Judy Carter, The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. And the idea is, and a lot of comics buy the book because they want to go from funny speaker to speaker who is funny. And so I went into the book thinking I got nothing to say. I got nothing to teach anybody. But halfway through, it hit me. You know, my grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. Then I came close enough to dying in 2010 by suicide. I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like. So I realized as I was preparing for the TEDx, that first one, that you know, at the time, 37,000 people died by suicide in the U.S. every year. Now it's 47,000, one every 11 minutes. But nobody's talking about it. But I figured out, if you just mention the words depression and suicide out loud, people will tell you the most amazing things, people, some of whom I've just met. And so I thought, well, there's a keynote, there's a speaking career. And what people hire me to do is simply, and they say this over and over, starting the conversation on suicide. Because if I start it, then other people will sort of have cover to talk about it. They can give voice to their feelings and experiences. I Have to Be Big and Rich is a singing duo. They've got a song, my personal favorite, called Somebody's Got to Be Unafraid to Lead the Freak Parade. So that's my job. I step up and I go, look, I'm depressed and suicidal. Like, take the barrel of my gun today. And that gives other people cover. And there, I pick certain industries, occupations that have high rates of suicide, dentists, veterinarians. Construction has the highest rate of suicide. So I market to those industries because they've got a problem and they want to do something about it. And so, the TEDx, my first one, was the beginning of my rebranding from funny speaker to speaker who's funny. And then I needed a brand name. And a friend of mine helped me come up with the mental health comedian because, you know, keywords, mental health, keyword, comedian. So, and oftentimes I get hired, you know, they've got choices of who to hire to talk about whatever it is, suicide prevention. But when they see that comedian and then 20 years writing for the Tonight Show, that oftentimes pushes me to the top of the list. So,
wow.
And it's two parts of my personality. I am a comedian, have been forever, and I am depressed. And I have something called chronic suicidality, meaning for me, the option of suicide is always on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. You saw my TED talk. Yes. I mentioned it several times. Yeah. My car broke down. I had three thoughts: get it fixed, buy a new one, or I could just kill myself. That's the thought process for somebody with chronic suicidality. And in the TED talk, I believe I mentioned somewhere along the line that often when I speak, somebody comes up afterwards and they've got that and they didn't know it had a name. And they just thought there was some kind of freak. And the relief is palpable that they're not alone. So I got an email from a guy in Switzerland last week. He said, Frank, I just watched your TED talk. I'm 42. I've got a lovely 8-year-old daughter, wonderful wife, and I'm miserable. I can't remember the last time I was happy. And he said, and I thought I was all alone. And then I stumbled onto your TED talk and realized I am not alone.
That is definitely impactful just by you, like you said, speaking out loud.
Yeah. Just letting other people know that they're, you know, people out there who are actually willing to get up on video on YouTube and go, I'm crazy as an outhouse rat. How about you?
I'm curious, when did you, or how early on
did you become aware of suicide as being an option that always like popped up when you went through certain things?
High school was fabulous. I loved high school. I tried to stay an extra year, and back then you could do that. But my first wife said, no, you'll be behind. I didn't know at the time that, you know, people don't always finish college in 4 years.
Sure.
Should stay behind, should stay back a year, learn more, you know, learn typing, take another Spanish class. Anyway, I went to college. She went to another college way across the country. Now, I was miserable, but I thought I was just lovesick. I believe I was clinically depressed. Then we got married, and we shouldn't have. I knew that going in, but didn't have the testicular fortitude to back out. And so as we got separated the first time, would have been the spring of 84, I think. Driving down 163 in San Diego about dusk. 5 o'clock is my lowest point in the day. And it was drizzling, and just had the thought, why don't you just kill yourself? Whoa, where did all that come from? That was my first conscious thought of, why don't you just go ahead and kill yourself? Okay. So, and then from that point on, it just became, you know, part of a pattern. If I get stressed or something went wrong, you know, hey, well, you can always kill yourself. So, yeah, at this point, when I hear that, I'm like, oh, there's a good idea. Yeah, that's a good idea. Because it's not a serious thought. You know, it's the young woman I spoke at a college, a young woman came up afterwards. Thank you for your keynote. You're welcome. But it made me weep. Why did it make you weep? She goes, well, you know, the part about your car, get it fixed, buy a new one, or you could just kill yourself. She goes, I've been having those thoughts my entire life. I just thought, I didn't know how to name. I just thought I was some kind of freak. And when I heard you say those words out loud, I realized for the first time in my life, I am not alone. And I wept. That's the ROI for me. That's the therapeutic piece for me. I told a crowd somewhere recently that I realized I'm like George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life. I've been shown by an angel, perhaps one that kept me from pulling the trigger, what these people's lives might be like if I were not there to let them know they're not alone.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I've steered them just far enough off the path of suicide to live a normal life.
Exactly.
That's kind of like George Bailey. You know, the angel showed him what Bedford Falls would look like if he had not been born. So
that's definitely a powerful return on investment.
Oh God. Oh Lord. Yeah. I mean, the check, don't get me wrong, Maurice, paycheck's good too. But that for me is terribly therapeutic. And by the way, it's why I can't kill myself now. That was my second thought. First thought was I'm George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life. Second thought was, oh, God, oh, no, oh, no, I can't kill myself. You know why? Because I would take all those people with me.
Mm.
And I got that lesson from a gentleman whose father was an alcoholic for a lot of years, got sober, and 20 years in AA, sponsored hundreds of people. Somewhere along the line, somebody said to him, do you think you'll ever drink again? He goes, I'll never drink again. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, because of all the people I sponsored and all the people I'm going to sponsor, if I dived into that bottle again, I would take them with me.
That's a good way to look at it, because somebody is depending on you that keeps you.
Yeah, well, and when people ask me, so let's say somebody says they're depressed, what comes next? Well, ask them if they're having thoughts of suicide. If they're having thoughts of suicide, ask them if they have a plan. If they have a plan, what is your plan? Now, if they're depressed and suicidal and the plan is not particularly specific, you know, if it's very specific, that's dangerous. Get them on the phone with the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. But it's not particularly specific. Next question should be, I believe, are you going to kill yourself? Let them give voice to that without, you know, locking them down for 3 days in a mental health facility. And if they say, no, I'm not going to kill myself, then the last question should be, I believe, then tell me why not. Make them give voice to why they're, and I would say, because I'm George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life. I cannot kill myself. A friend of mine said, you couldn't live with that. I said, no, I couldn't die with that.
That's great insight, because I know being in the mental health field myself, it's, these laws that come out. So it's more fear-based why we would have someone Baker act, you know, instead.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's more fear-based if they can't tell us. And, you know, can assure us they won't harm themselves, you know, then we usually go down that path for sure.
Well, and I think that we would have fewer suicides if people were allowed to give voice to those feelings, because, you know, oftentimes you're in the mental health field, you hear it. Yeah, the guy never made any indication, never said anything. You know, I had no idea. Well, you know why he didn't say anything? Didn't want to be Baker acted. You know, I mean, it's, you know, it's if we could we allow people like me, because, you know, if let's say you and I are in California and you're doing some therapy on me, and I tell you, you know, Frank, you're depressed. Yes. Thoughts of suicide. Oh, yeah. Got a plan. Got a half a dozen plans. Just the way I'm wired. And, you know, next thing you know, I'm in front of a judge with you and he's putting me. You know, we're doing an IDO, involuntary detention order, because I said out loud to a therapist in California, you know, I'm having thoughts of suicide. So, like I said, fear-based. So I wouldn't – I met a guy in California, Maurice, at another event. It was a comedy thing, strictly comedy. The USS there's a aircraft carrier there. They got parked there. I can't think which one it is. But anyway, they have like 500 docents, and so I was doing comedy at the docent banquet. And I'm sitting at a table, and of course, it always comes up as comedy. All you do, and no, I speak on suicide, whatever. So I'm walking to the bathroom. The guy's right beside me. He goes, Frank, I have chronic suicidality as well. I didn't realize it had a name, he said. I just felt like a freak. Okay, that's standard operating procedure. And he was 67 years old. And he said, stop me outside the bathroom. He goes, I want you to know that I've never told anybody what I just told you, not even my therapist.
Powerful.
Because California 5150, you know, therapists by law might feel compelled to, you know, have him locked down for 3 days.
Yes, certainly.
And that's why he didn't tell him. He was worried the therapist would freak out and lock him down.
Yeah. And this,
but what if he could give voice to those things? What if he could do it without, you know, without that, the threat of that? I mean, somebody, if somebody is honest to God, serious, immediate danger to themselves, different.
True.
But just thoughts of suicide, you know.
True. True. That is true. So when did you, I know these things happened in your family, as you mentioned earlier, about suicide, but when did you really get it that, you know, there was mental health issues within your family?
Well, the generation prior to mine, my mother's generation, for all their goodness and wonderfulness, when I was with my mother and found my great aunt, and it's in my first TED talk, you've seen it, you know, it's horrible.
Yes.
I must have compartmentalized it because I had no conscious memory of it. So the family created a myth about how, when she passed away, how serene she was, hands folded in prayer, serene. So that was the family line for decades, until 2012 or 2013, when I was home and my cousin owns a restaurant in Raleigh. He's 10 years older than I am. So he would be, you know, he would have known about it all as a teenager. So he would have a vivid memory of the incident. And I was describing the, you know, the hands folded in prayer thing. And he goes, what? No. And he told me the real story. And you've heard the real story. And it all came flooding back. A wall in my, some brick, wherever I had it compartmentalized, the walls blew away and I was there again. And it all came back. And then I began to take note. My sister's on medicine for anxiety and depression. Pretty much everybody in my family, except that one cousin I just mentioned. The joke I wrote was, more nuts in my family than a 25-pound bag of squirrel food. Everybody has an issue. The good news is, because they're all out about it, the nieces and nephews don't have any problem saying, look, I think I'm depressed, or I think I got a touch of OCD, or whatever it is. There's no stigma in the family about mental health.
Yeah.
So they will be mentally healthier, that generation, my nieces and nephews, than we were, because the adults are out about it.
Well, that is good to hear that, you know, the next generation is getting more of the help they need at an earlier time, I'm assuming.
Yeah, without recrimination, without, you know, they make no bones about it. I've got this issue.
Yeah. So that was, you had all that trauma within you and you just kind of locked it away from 4 years old, and then, you know, having this conversation with your family member, it like brought it all back.
Yeah, it brought it all. Yeah, wherever I had it walled off, It came flooding back.
Wow. Yeah, so trauma, it definitely is stored in our bodies for sure.
Well, and I was just watching The Affair on Showtime. And they were talking about trauma and how there are some studies. I mean, The Affair is fictional. But they were talking about so there are some studies that trauma is passed down.
Yes.
From parents to child. They also said that the good news is resilience. You know, if trauma can be passed down, resilience may be able to be passed down as well genetically in the epigenetic world. So it's not just the trauma, but
it's the resilience.
Yeah. It's depression. The kids nowadays, I think the teen rate of self-reported major depressive disorder and the teen rate of suicide have spiked. They're about 50% higher than they were in 2012.
Yes, there has been a spike for sure. And I know some contributing factors to it. I know. I think also this generation is a little behind the eight ball in developing social skills.
You think?
Yeah.
Yeah. I said to somebody the other day, I feel like a woman when I'm talking to a teenager. No, don't look at my chest. My eyes are up here.
Yeah, the social skills and being able to develop that inner strength, meaning like during high school or in grade school and middle school, you always came into a bully or someone who picked on you and you had to learn how to navigate through words or negotiate and or fight. Sometimes you just had to fight. So you learn how to do that and you develop strength by doing that. But now bullying is illegal. So oftentimes it's kind of taken off the table. So as kids grow up, they've never had to strengthen themselves mentally. So when they go off to college and sometimes they face something really difficult or hard, they don't know what to do. And they reverse to harming themselves or doing various other things.
Well, and I think parents have some responsibility. You know, the helicopter parents, you know,
yes,
hovering over them. And now I guess there's something called the snowplow parents, where they plow the road ahead of the kids. So,
yeah,
you know, make it easy as possible.
But it's not a good thing. Just like the bird has to develop its strength, the mom can't, you know, fly for them. So,
yeah,
no doubt about it. There has to be some struggle in order to build up the strength that you need. So was there, you talked about it earlier, was there a particular event that led you to grabbing the gun? Thankfully, you didn't use it, but was there something that happened in particular, or was it just accumulation of things that made you feel that depressed?
Oh no, it was not an accumulation. It was, you know, with the recession and my business dropping off 80%, we lost everything in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, and I'd been responsible for the finances. So even though I would put some of the blame on Lehman Brothers for crashing the world economy, you know, toxic mortgages, I felt responsible. My wife was suffering greatly, and people who have mental illness, I found, tend to be more empathetic than neuronormal people. And we tend to feel pain, others' pain, more acutely. Matter of fact, my next TED talk is called Depressive Realism. Maybe the glass really is half empty. There's some science that says that depressed people see the world more accurately than people who are neuronormal. There's something called negative cognitive bias, which depressed people have, but there's also something called positive cognitive bias, which means that normal people may be seeing the world more like they wish it were than it actually is. So I tanked our world and I had a life insurance policy for $1 million. And so, you know, people think you hear this, suicide's a selfish act, not in the mind oftentimes of the person who's doing it, because there's something called burdensomeness, you know, one of the three legs of the stool of suicidal thoughts. other two, isolation and the capacity. And so I felt like a burden, and I had $1 million life insurance policy, and I knew my wife would miss me and it would break her heart, but she'd be restored financially. So I was going to kill myself for the insurance so she could get $1 million. But I didn't know how long I'd had the policy, and my policy had a 2-year suicide clause, meaning if you killed yourself anytime in the first 2 years, they just returned the premiums. If you killed yourself 2 years in a day, then she gets $1 million. I called my insurance agent. How long have I had the policy? He didn't realize right away what I was asking, because I really wasn't asking how long I've had the policy. I was asking for permission to kill myself. When he came back on and said 22 months, and then he said, no, don't do it. Because he delivered checks before. People called him, asked him, killed themselves. He delivered checks. When he hung up, he said, because I talked to him later, he told his wife, I think Frank's going to kill himself. So I couldn't kill myself. I couldn't leave my wife brokenhearted and broke. So I had to wait 2 months to kill myself. And because oddly, ironically, because of my chronic suicidality, because I have the capacity to do it anytime, that allowed me to go on. I figured, well, you know, 2 months in a day, I can do it. So I can survive 2 months because I know the pain will end at 2 months in a day. So fortunately, when 2 months in a day rolled around, I don't even remember the day. It wasn't like I went, whew. You know? It just kept moving forward at that point, and here we are. But that's what saved me. It was a life insurance policy. Had 2 months before it would pay the $1 million. So in my mind, it was an unselfish act because it would, you know, I was worth more dead than alive to my wife. Now, if you ask her, she would have said, no, I don't want the money. I want you. We'll work this out. But, you know.
Well, thankful that he was not only doing his job, but he was receptive and to, you know, well, why would he even ask this question? And
he said when we talked, I called him, let him know the YouTube video had posted and I put his name in it. And he said, you know, Frank, when I realized what you were asking, I didn't know what to say, as many people don't when you, you know, you think somebody's suicidal. He said, so I said a quick prayer and I just hoped to God whatever came out of my mouth was the right thing. And I said, because he said, don't do it. I said, Graham, what I've learned in mental health is it's not so much the right thing, is say something. Because 8 out of 10 people are ambivalent and they want somebody to say something.
Yeah, they have a conversation. Yeah.
Yep.
True. So who has been the most influential person in your life?
My wife, I think. Well, my mom, of course. We're writing a book. It's done. We just have to, we'll probably publish it in the next couple of months on men's mental health. And then the dedication, I thank my mom for the way I was raised, my darling little sister, and my wife, who Wendy, who has believed in me even when I didn't believe in myself, who's encouraged me to follow my gift. She goes, I think that's where your joy is. That's where the money is. You need to follow your gift. So I've been, you know, because I've told speaker coaching clients, comedy coaching clients, you know, feel like quitting. I go, look, I've quit comedy and speaking 1,000 times. Next morning, the only difference is next morning, you know, I start over 1,001. So,
yeah, touching story. No, the time is elapsing on us. This, I've definitely enjoyed talking to you. You have so much insight on this area for sure. Is there, like, I would say, is there hope for people who have chronic suicidality?
Yeah, I think the hope for me came in an odd way. One, I believe it's just tied up with my abilities. You know, you saw my mental with benefits TEDx about how mentally ill people tend to have a superpower.
Yes.
So I believe I'm mentally disabled and mentally abled, and it's all part of one package. The second thing is, I'm never going to be, I used to say I battle depression, but that's not true because battle implies I can win. I'm never going to win. I can tie, you know, and stay alive, or I can lose and die by suicide, but I can't beat it. So I try to blend with the energy, kind of an Aikido. There's a martial arts called Aikido, and Aikido is all about blending with the energy of your, you know, whatever's coming at you. So I try to blend with the energy rather than oppose it. Like OCD, I try to use it because it's a powerful force.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I wouldn't, if I could take a pill and never have another depressed thought and never be suicidal again, but not process things like I do as a comedian, I wouldn't take the pill. I'll take the downside to live with my superpowers.
Gotcha.
So, that's helped me, you know, like once I realized there's no beating it, there's no getting well, this is just part of me. And it's you know, it's part and parcel of my talents. And, you know, it's just the way, you know, like anything else, it's, you know, there's good things and bad things about it.
Yeah. When you said, when you gave that illustration about blending with the energy, I thought about Bruce Lee, one of his quotes. He said, everything in life is a force. I can either embrace it, deflect it, but why in the world would I ever oppose it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And in Aikido, when somebody's coming at you, let's say they throw a punch, you actually step offline out of the way and you blend, you grab their wrist as it goes by and blend with their energy. Mm-hmm. And then in every Aikido technique, both people at some point are facing the same direction, seeing the world from the same perspective, at which point the attacker can break off the attack if they went, oh, well, that's why you, oh, okay, I see what you see.
Yeah.
Which is one of the things I love about Aikido is that all of a sudden you're both looking at the same thing from the same perspective. And, you know,
yeah.
So, yeah, I just try to blend with, because the depression has a powerful energy. I'm with Bruce Lee. Why oppose it? Why would you ever oppose it?
Yeah. So how can people get in contact with you?
Well, I've put my phone number, my cell number in the show notes.
Okay.
I put it up on the screen every keynote I do because I tell people, look, if you're suicidal, call the hotline. If you're just, you're mentally ill and just having a really bad day, call a crazy person because we're less likely to be judgmental. We're just going to listen. And as a friend of mine says, co-sign your BS. Just listening, ooh and ah, oh God, oh Lord, I can't, oh man. And we're not going to do what they call in the mental health business. I imagine you've heard this. We're not going to, I'm not going to should all over you. You should do this and you should do that and you should try fish oil.
Yes.
So yeah, just, and people call me, Maurice, they go, I can't believe this is your cell number. Well, how cruel would that be to put it up there and then have it be some bogus number?
That's, yeah, that would be bad.
And people call me not only because they're suicidal, but they've got a loved one who is having problems or their college roommates posting on Facebook and they're frightened by what they're saying. You know, is this dangerous, Frank? So they call for a variety of reasons. Just give somebody, you know, if you have somewhere to reach out, somebody's gonna pick up the phone and care.
Yeah.
A sliver of hope. That's all I'm really about, is giving somebody just a little bit of hope.
You definitely do that, just through your comedy and your caring nature to help others. I mean, you are definitely doing that. So at the end of the show, I'd like to give people the opportunity to, well, give my guests the opportunity to give a piece of advice or something that's called one to grow on. What would be one to grow on you would leave with our audience today?
There's a, this is going to sound odd, but hardly anybody knows about this. You hear people say all the time, my antidepressant's not working. I've been on two or three and it just, you know, I have to go on, then taper off, go on, taper off. There's a DNA cheek swab, you know, Q-tip test for psychotropics. There are four or five companies on the web. They take your DNA and they put it up against all these psychotropics, let's say antidepressants, and they try to find the one or two that, given your DNA, would work best with your metabolism. So it cuts down on the experimentation, the lab rat stuff, you know, the going on and tapering off. And you can get them from those companies on the web, or you can go to Rite Aid. I met a pharmacist on a plane the other day who goes, Frank, look, that's available over the counter at Rite Aid for $40. So, but I can't tell you how many clinicians I've talked to that have never even heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's, you know, it's epigenetics. It's that, you know, they, nowadays they can find, I've got a gene for high cholesterol. 1 in 200 people have it. And that's one of the things they can test for with that DNA cheek swab, to see if you got that particular cholesterol gene, or, you know, a gene for diabetes or gene for whatever. Just so happens that they can test your DNA against, you know, this long list of psychotropic medications and find the ones that they believe work best with your metabolism. So that one piece of advice, one tip is, you know, if you're struggling with your medication, get the test. It's a couple hundred bucks from your doctor. It's $40 at Rite Aid.
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.